I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Teaching meditation can be a deeply rewarding experience. Help others improve their mental and emotional well-being, reduce stress, improve focus, increase self-awareness and self-regulation, all while deepening your own practice and understanding. Join acclaimed author, Buddhist teacher, and Emmy Award-winning musician David Nickturn on Tuesday, May 28th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time for a free online discussion on teaching meditation in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/be-here-now for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn on May 28th.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
That's why in a death-phobic culture, when euthanasia is legalized, the death phobia remains intact. It's not challenged. It's not softened. It's amped up to the point now where you shouldn't have to die and you shouldn't have to suffer either. And it kind of begs the question, man, what are you doing here?
Hi, everyone. It's Raghu, and I'm back with another edition of Mind Rolling, and I'm back with somebody we just said hello for the first time, Stephen Jenkinson. Stephen, thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation.
So, Stephen wrote a book some years ago, right? This Die Wise is the name of the book.
Yeah, 2015 it was.
Uh-huh. So 8 years ago, A Manifesto for Sanity and Soul, and I'll attest to the sanity and soul for sure. It's quite a tome that you have written here.
I hope you meant tome, not tomb.
Tune. It's no. It's quite a tune you have written, actually.
Oh, tune.
Yes.
I heard tomb with an M.
Yeah, no, M-B. That's probably what it was. But I'm rethinking and going, yeah, this was a great tune.
Thank you.
Tome. Yeah, it's. I just mean it's chock full of all sorts of information and provocations about how we treat death in this country, and that is going to be the subject of this podcast.
Okay. And that is a fair assessment of what I tried to do, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. Can you, just to get going, just to get to know you, we both just found out or realized we're both from Canada.
Right.
And where you're from? Are you from the west side of Canada or east?
No, I'm Easterner. So Eastern Ontario, around the Great Lakes Basin.
Right.
For that's where I was born and grew up, and then
really
school in Boston, actually. So I can imitate that accent, although I won't do it to you. And then parts unknown has welcomed me, you know, in the days since. But all the formative time was red and white Canadian, for sure.
Yeah. So we live not right now. I'm from Montreal, as many people know, listen to the podcast. And Stephen isn't more than 5 hours from there as we speak. So
right.
to a little bit about, I guess, I mean, I remember reading that you remember stuff when you were like 3 years old about what in the hell is this all about? What is this guy? What is, you know, the curious questions. Can we start there to give an idea of what led you to be such a profound life involved in this particular subject?
Well, that's quite an achieved thing, if it were indeed true. I'm not sure 3 years old in particular marks the time, but I can tell you this.
Yeah.
I'm quite sure that people credit me with quite a memory, and I'm glad they do. I don't really think that's what it is, though. What I have is a kind of ear for the cadence and the loping qualities of stories.
Mm.
And I can hear it. And when I hear it, the stories begin to assemble themselves or reassemble themselves in my anticipation of what's coming. So it's not quite memory. It's something subtler, I feel. It's not factual, really. And how did that come about? I'm sure I was read to in the womb, but failing that, certainly from a very early age. And I think the cadence of the human voice is something that came to me early and often, and something that became imminently trustworthy to the point now where my ear, as many people's ear does, distinguishes between the cadence of story and the cant of argument. And when it comes to argument, generally speaking, I just go the other way.
Mm.
And the reason for that is there's something about the structure of argument that is somehow hostile in principle to the way the human mind seems to work to me. In that it's very, I mean, if you follow this for a second, it's quite wondrous. You enter into an argument. Yeah. A couple of days later, you remember that you argued, but you're hard-pressed to recreate what you argued about or the nature, the flow of the argument per se. Just the intensity is available to you and maybe a few highlights and so on. Why is that? I think it's because the human memory in particular is not inclined to that kind of agitation. But a story, amazingly, begins to tell itself and retell itself as soon as you enter into it. You can say, for example, I don't remember how this goes. It was, but anyway, there was this thing, and it's all you have to do. And as you enter into it, the story begins to murmur itself across the filaments of your memory, I think. And as it does, it's astounding how it reassembles. Or literally, this is the actual meaning of the word, it remembers itself.
Mm.
So I'm a fan, as you can clearly tell.
Yeah.
And I'm very lucky that I was read to in that way. I don't know about the quality of what I was read to, but certainly the cadence was more than enough.
Right. And what's behind it in terms of the depth of the human that read it.
Yeah.
To you.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but then what propelled you from your youth into, I know you went to, at one point, Harvard Divinity School.
Right.
What propelled you into that direction?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I tried to get into the priesthood of, as I like to call it, something or other, when I went to Harvard in the late 1970s. And a niggling detail emerged in the interview process. And that was that I had never been to church of any description, kind, or stripe. Now, I didn't think that was a big roadblock to joining. But clearly the powers that be thought otherwise. And I think in retrospect, they were right. You know, they wouldn't have me. And I think that was wise on their part. Mm. And so I had to find some conduit for whatever that was animating me and manifesting me. And the thing that I tried to translate into priesthood or devotional life, I had to find another translation. You know, and I don't say that with any animus at all towards any organized religion. I mean, I genuinely mean it. I'm not really an organizational guy, so I think it was wise for all concerned.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow, and I don't take a lot of credit for this, I've seemed to have fashioned a kind of alternative monastic proposition for myself.
Uh-huh.
And I don't live the full life of self-denigration and so on that you might equate with monastic life, but the sense of devotion and the notion that things are not what they could be and probably should be has been there for a long time. And I've had to translate away from grievance and towards grief and something in the order of, okay, so what's to be done? In other words, now that the gods have spoken and we are in the state that we're in, what's to be done? That seems to have occupied me deeply in for the full duration of the second half of my life.
Mm. What about, do you have any connectivity at all to Eastern? Have you studied Eastern mysticism?
Not in the least, actually. And it is a huge, obvious gap in my education. I had my hands full with the West. That's the way I've come to understand it. The West is a two-fisted operation, and they've received, or we've received, the sum total of my focus and my, if I can use a technical term, my give a shit.
Yeah, but I do notice, Stephen, in this book. Mm-hmm. That's why I asked that question, because there was some connectivity, at least maybe because I'm, you know, I studied there a lot and lived there a lot. Maybe I'm connecting stuff that maybe isn't there, but I did get that in different, as reading through the book. Yeah.
I do get that. And I don't have any axe to grind about the resemblance. I'd say, well, I'll tell you a story that says it better than just a one line observation.
Okay.
So years ago, when I was gainfully employed, and I was an organizational guy for about 20 minutes, well, literally several years, but not very long, in the hospital system in Ontario. Mm. That's the death trade days that I refer to in Die Wise and so on. And the phone rang. And there was a woman calling me. She was the executive director of the Native Canadian Friendship Center. And she was inviting me to come talk there, which was, you know, on the face of it, unusual and worthy of some questioning. So I asked her, how did she hear about me and what did she have in mind? And she said, oh, anything that's on your mind, you know, whatever you want to come and teach. I said, you know, again, how did you hear about me? She said, well, you did this thing, remember, a month or so ago? Oh, yes, I said. She said, well, I had a couple of staff people there. And they came back and they were quite impressed with you and what you had said and all of that. And then she paused and she said, and the thing that really got me is they said, you know, finally, we got somebody on the inside. Hmm. Quote. And there was a long pause and I put together what she was saying or what her staff people were saying to her. And I said, you mean, you had staff people who came to something I did, were with me all day, and came back and told you that I'm a Native guy. And she said, yeah. Obviously thinking that was the case.
Mm.
So what I'm saying is, in this particular example, these people heard something that was familiar enough to them.
Yeah.
That they did a kind of involuntary math and figured, he's got to be a Native guy, because where else would it come from?
Yeah, yeah.
And I say the same thing about things Eastern. You know, they may not be exclusive to the Eastern part of the world or to Eastern religions or mysticism or thing. They may have tendrils elsewhere, and the resemblances should be encouraging. I find it encouraging. You know, it's not a consequence of devotion. It's a consequence of, I don't know, an interesting kind of resemblance that somebody who comes from where I come from could be at first pass, at least, mistaken for a kind of Buddhist positive guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know what you know about me or particularly somebody who died recently, 4 years ago, who I have worked with and been close to, Ram Dass. See, everybody out there, we have really not talked at all, and this is all sharing our lives together on this podcast. So he introduced me. He's a big cultural, and you know, countercultural figure, Tim Leary and Richard Alpert, which you do know. And he went to India and he met his guru. And I met him in Montreal, of all things, when I was running a radio station there. Anyhow, long and the short, I did get to, I wanted to, you know, the stories were extraordinary that he was relaying about this being. So I did get there and I did meet him. And the connection here to what you're saying is this. The very first thing, over many days of my first being there, there was a few Westerners. You know, we were young hippies in our early 20s, in the early 70s. It was all about, there's only one, he didn't speak English. It was all through translators and so on. And yeah. I'll be colloquial in terms of what what he said, the transmission was, there's only one thing going on. There is, in Hindi, it was called Subek. It's all one. And you go, Christ, Krishna, Hanuman, Buddha, Mohan, one. There's only one thing going on. And we got it demonstrated to us in many different ways over the 3 years we were with him. I was there a year and a half. And so the idea that my mistaking in some way, in a superficial way, that you had no real connectivity to studies of Eastern mysticism, yet I was getting this core deliverance of a message. And and the reality is, this is, no matter what, in our human experience of going within to divine that which is the stuff of who we really are, the same different containers, but the same essence is there once you do that, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I should say that my disavowal is not entirely accurate, because when I was going to the Harvard Divinity School, I was a foreign student, right? Alien. Yeah. And as a result, my employment opportunities were severely curtailed. But one option was to be a janitor at the Center for the Study of World Religions across the street from the Divinity School. Mm. I was that janitor. And in so doing, I met Jains and Zoroastrians and Buddhists. And I can't think of any other groups right off the top of my head. But so I'm not completely devoid of contact, you know, but it wasn't study. Yeah. It was,
right.
We would often sit there and just ruminate about the mysteries of life for 15 minutes before my sense of responsibility caught up with me and I pushed the broom a little further.
That's great. That's where Ram Dass went. Richard Alpert and Tim Leary were involved with the psychedelic experiments at Harvard in the mid-60s, early 60s. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's that whole story.
So I was there 10, probably 12 years later, something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the book. And the core message, which again, you know, I do reference Ram Dass. He was a teacher back in the day. Then he became a friend, and then he got a stroke. And he was in Maui, actually living there.
Right.
We created a situation for his friends where he was able to continue because of the wonders of the internet. But
I did meet him, by the way. I should say.
Oh, you did.
I did meet him briefly in Maui.
Oh. Uh-huh.
You know.
Well, this I did not know.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
Yeah, the way it happened was the Canadian government, through the NFB, National Film Board of Canada, produced a film about the work I was doing at the time in the death tree called Griefwalker. And there was a kind of small private think tank, I guess I would call them, on Maui, who were alert to the existence of the film, got in touch with me, asked me if I'd consider coming to Maui to teach this material. Mm. And they said, we have a board of directors. We're going to show the film and we're just seeing if you're interested and if it's unanimous or if the majority rules, then the invitation will be formal. And so Ram Dass was the third person on this triumvirate of decision makers about whether I was going to be invited to Maui or not. And apparently he didn't like the film, or he didn't like me, or one of the, I don't know which of the two. And so he voted no, but the other two voted yes. So I ended up there anyway. And then I did meet him completely by happenstance. He was, he'd been driven in a van to a place where I guess he got physiotherapy routinely. And I was walking down the sidewalk with the guy who brought me at the very moment that his van opened up, and there he sat. and so we actually met in that moment. And he looked at me, he kind of glared, I would say, but who knows? I mean, I don't know what the look meant. Cause I, you know, given the stroke and so forth, whatever it meant, I don't know. And he said, I've seen your movie. He said, and I laughed and I said, I heard.
And that was it?
That was it, man.
Oh my God. That's funny. Well, Bodie B was part of that, right?
Bodie was, this is the guy who brought me, correct?
Yeah. 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 I'm not sure I remember. It's something in there that makes me think, I was around or something at the time, or he might have mentioned it to me. That's crazy. That's great.
Yeah.
But what I was trying to say is, I mean, you're totally on the same page. Ram Dass was all about this country, the West particularly treats death in a way that is just so gigantically negative for everyone's lives in all stratas of society and government and all of it. So, you know, that you guys were right there together on that one. Mm-hmm. But I like this. You say the way we die has been drawn up into the system so thoroughly that it's likely your grandparents wouldn't recognize anything that would be routine care when it's your turn.
Right.
High-tech healthcare has become an undeclared war on dying itself, nothing less. Caveat emptor. Why don't you give us a general idea of I think we all have some connectivity to it, especially if we're a little bit older. It doesn't have to be as old as we are, but what is it that you're getting to here in terms of how lost we are?
I should say, first of all, that I'm not shooting from the hip. I paid my dues. I spent time in the trench. I was there. I was there and administratively, and I was kicked up the ladder rather quickly. So I saw things at a number of levels. I ended up as a associate professor at the medical school, for example. So I did see this stuff from the inside. So it's not a hatchet job. The book Die Wise is emphatically not a hatchet job against anybody's medical system or the people who work there. Okay. I'm saying the dilemmas are societal, fundamentally, not really. They're not specific or unique to the healthcare system, either in my country or the one you're in now. And lo and behold, though, I think the dilemma may come to something as simple and heartbreaking as the following. The rate of medical innovation in medical technology is so extreme. It's beyond your wildest reckoning. That's earlier in that quote that you say, that's what the allusion to the generational divide, that people simply wouldn't recognize routine healthcare. I mean, when you are in serious need of it, you will have the same experience. You simply won't believe what they can and will and would do to you in the name of, quote, caring for you. And it really challenges your understanding of what constitutes care, you see. So here's the dilemma, and it's a practical dilemma as well as a moral and ethical dilemma. The innovation is rampaging forward, ever cresting waves of who the hell knows what this means? Should we be using this technology? You know, and so on. So the practice wisdom that should be guiding its use continues to lag behind further and generationally further and further again, to the point where the physicians in particular are taking their cues from the purveyors of the technology, not from the ethics committees that should be having a lot of hesitation about the whole matter. And the reason for that is, on the other end of the story, the system has deeply insistent consumers of these products and methodologies in the form of patients and their families. And so it's a rock and a hard place story. The patients want the best. They want the latest. They want the greatest. You see, they don't want to hear about the ethical, you know, subtleties and the dilemmas that ensue. They don't want to be in a test group. They don't want to be in a placebo situation. They want the real thing all the time. And their loved ones want that for them, as you'd expect. The consequence then is nobody gets to find out a priori what all of this means and what it's doing to us. And the legalization of euthanasia, although it's not called that here, it's called MAID as an acronym, Medical MAID. Assistance in Dying, uh-huh. Correct?
Yeah.
That is turning into something so somber-making and so haunted, because it's gone from, you know, people should not have to suffer. We make dogs suffer less than we make dying people suffer, all of that. And that's why MAID is there. To, in a very short number of years, the qualifications for MAID are being proposed in the Canadian Parliament to not any longer be predicated upon the proximity of death. Now you should have access to MAID just because you're, and I'm not sure what word to use here, suffering, fundamentally unhappy, incorrigibly depressed. All of these things become the new threshold for whether or not you should be allowed to take yourself out, and you should oblige the state to cooperate with you. This is where we are. And anybody who wanted to see it could see this coming, because it had nothing to do with dying. That's why in a death-phobic culture, when euthanasia is legalized, the death phobia remains intact. It's not challenged. It's not softened. It's amped up to the point now where you shouldn't have to die and you shouldn't have to suffer either. And it kind of begs the question, man, what are you doing here? If you've disqualified death and dying and you've disqualified suffering, I mean, there's not a lot of life left that once you eliminate those two issues and those two presences, seems to me. I mean, I'm not saying that all of life comes to that, but without those things, without limits and frailties and endings, then everything we're talking about has no meaning. You can't find it. Everybody's left to their own devices to, you know, swing away as best they can. And there's not a lot of life training, not in the West, to take upon yourself the kind of Oppenheimer responsibility. Do you know what I mean by that reference?
No.
Well, of course, the film's out now. I haven't seen it, but
if
you're old enough, you're generally
you're
aware of his story, and that he quotes the Bhagavad Gita at the moment of the detonation in the desert. Yeah. And he realizes that something is now afoot that can't be caged again and won't be. And he goes further and he says, we have taken the power of annihilation into our hands. Who among us is qualified, readied, capable? And the answer surely is no one. No one is. And there we are. And within how many years, it was brinksmanship all over the place, and Kennedy and the, and you know, the Bay of Pigs and the whole thing. And you know, how far away are we now with Chernobyl and the war in Ukraine and Putin saying what he's saying and threatening and saber rattling and so on. And all of this comes from the fact that, you know, we could have done the thing. And I'm not, I have no opinion about whether, you know, that technology should have been dropped on people in Japan. And I don't know, it's vast. And did it save lives? It's very hard to say that you kill lives to save lives.
Yeah.
But maybe at some level, there's a case to be made. I can't make it. But God knows now we're in the backwaters. We're in the backwash of something that no one really anticipated. The same thing in a more muted fashion is happening with medical technology, it seems to me.
Mm. Yeah. Wow.
That's why I wrote the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like I said, it's not a slander. It's not an expose. It's a plea.
Well, at the core of it all, Stephen, is it not that one word, fear? And do you think, I believe that's kind of the work that I've been doing and that we do in terms of, you know, continuing the teachings that we've been given from India, from this particular being, is to address fear and separation.
Well, yes, indeed. Fearful people are scary people. You don't know what's going to happen when people are deeply invested in their fears and rationalize their fears, mobilize them, attach them to a creed of some description, assemble a core of grievance around their fears. Yeah, that's very tangibly dangerous business. So yes, I'd agree with you.
Yeah. But I think just the basic human fear of death, which is endemic in every being. Some beings have dealt with that fear through various methodologies, perhaps, and they're not subject to this polarization that really you're talking about. You know, the polarization of completely not making any kind of approach to the reality of life, birth, life, and death.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, here's something from the book. I have seen waking up expecting to live. This is, this waking up expecting to live is an amazing thing, right? I have seen waking up expecting to live every day on the job, and I've seen what it does for us. I've seen that there's a diminished ability to suffer. There is little instinct or capacity for grieving. There's a headlong flight away from discomfort, hardship, dying. There's a degree and a kind of depression here that would be declared some kind of emergency if it were known to be the widespread thing it is. Waking up as we do is job security for all the mental health professional in your yellow pages. I love those few lines. But yeah, I mean, we start to say, well, how can we approach some kind of detente with our perspective on death? How do we do that? Well, we can't do it until, how about we start approaching suffering, just basic suffering, and have a different perspective on that. I just believe that that's extraordinarily important in terms of making friends, shall we say, with the concept of death.
I think if we cultivated a capacity to be sad, we'd make enormous headroads into our propensity for fear.
Mm.
I think sadness is an absolutely compelling and legitimate alternative. But it needs at least as much tuition as fear does. You have to learn to be afraid, obviously. And you have to learn sadness as well. It's not an inevitably occurring substance, you know, regardless of the circumstance. I mean, sadness is not depression. It's not despair. It's much closer to sorrow. And it belongs. And this is absolutely, I mean, I would never talk somebody out of their sadness when it comes to dying. I mean, the thought of it makes me abundantly sad, I have to say. And I'm not working to get on the other side of the sadness, to be honest. I think the sadness is its own wisdom.
Mm. Yes. Yes, indeed. I mean, this is how we grow. It's at that Leonard Cohen famous song, The Crack Lets the Light In.
Right.
Yeah, no, this is extremely important. Yeah, we have such an aversion to just, I mean, I know this in myself, just in any kind of uncomfortable circumstances. I've spent a lot of time in India, so there's a lot of physical discomfort there, just the nature of a third world.
Oh, yeah.
And the presence of this perspective that seems endemic to us humans, you know, the gravitating towards what is the easiest path, what is the most comfortable path. And, you know, this is a great difficulty.
Yeah. Sadness, I would say, is life-affirming. The fear of death, the clinging on to life for its own sake at all costs, is not life-affirming. All it does is reiterate the upside of life and feed the grievance when the upside passes from view, either temporarily or eventually permanently, right? So grievance has no place in grief, I would say. And these things are acres, miles apart. Grief, as I understand it, and you probably came across quotes to this effect in the book, grief is a skill. Not an affliction.
Mm.
Grief is not a feeling you have about something. Grief is the something.
Mm. Yeah.
Isn't there a story? I don't know it well at all. But you know it up, down, and sideways, very likely. So the Buddha, when he's a young lad or an adolescent, is living in the life of Riley, is he not? And quite mm-hmm. comfortable.
In the castle, yeah.
There you are. And then he hops over the wall, does he not? And his encounter with the real thing is utterly overwhelming.
Yeah.
For him, no? And it's perhaps, my guess, it's the beginning of his real tuition. It's the beginning of the tempering of his heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, I mean, if it happened to him, you know, it should happen to a good number of the rest of us too, it seems to me. And it does, minus the tuition of the heart business. I mean, it often goes in the direction of medication and self-soothing of all kinds, as you've said, and reiteration of the fundamental rights and privileges of a consumer in a consumer culture.
Yeah.
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 You can't consume dying.
Even with all of that, the going back to the fear factor.
Yeah.
Even though, yes, I mean, the advancements that society has made and worldwide to keep you alive longer, which is the basic desire of people who encounter death. I mean, everything I've seen, you're there day to day and you have far more first-hand experience, but that seems to be what is going on. Even with that, because that's very difficult for us now to deny as an individual. It's in our DNA that we want to survive. So not to take advantage of the enormous advances made in medicine to help you survive. I mean, to me, that's I'm not sure how that issue can be bridged, you know, in a way that makes sense, you know, which is part of
it. I have a suggestion.
Okay.
I have a suggestion. I agree with you halfway that it's true that most people, the vast majority of people, wanted to persist, okay? And they took steps and made decisions predicated on that desire. I don't know that they're well-informed decisions, but nonetheless, this was their mobilizing principle. But nobody really told them what it costs to deke your time. Okay, when you sidestep your time, there is a consequence that nobody seems to figure on. And it's this, it's basically, you're taking the suicide's risk, are you not? That it's no better, that it's no different on the other side of all this. It's very similar. When you bargain for more time in and of itself becomes the goal. The quality of that time is absolutely irrelevant when you're bargaining for it. But when you get it, I'm here to tell you, it doesn't look like what you thought. And then before you know it, all the advanced directives, all the living wills, all the get me out of here, beam me up, Scotty stuff, all of that stuff is out the window now because nobody was ready for the downside of more time. But there's a distinct downside to more time, and this is what it is. If you're dying anyway, more time means more dying, period. Who's signing up for that? Who puts that in their living will? Nobody. And when it comes down the pipe, and it does, and there's no recourse except stop, just stop everything. And I mean, nobody on the care providing end knows what to listen to when you are in extremis and you're flailing about saying, get me out of here, just kill me. I can't stand it anymore. What about it can't you stand? And you know what one of the answers is? The vast acreage of your disappointment.
Which is?
And a sense of having been betrayed by the deal or the bargain you entered into. Mm-hmm. You're not betrayed. You've entered into an arrangement where betrayal is part of the deal. You see, because you didn't consider the fullness of the operation. And the fullness is this noble conveyance, which is your body, can only do so much. And your will doesn't take the hint. Mm-hmm. It's an awful thing. You know, your will says, let's go, let's keep going. And your body says, listen, I'm going over here. You be stupid by yourself. And back and forth it goes. Right? And, you know, the body wins by losing, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The body wins by losing. And the will goes, you know, what the hell's that? So even, that's what kept me busy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, but even with all of that and recognizing most people end up in this particular situation of elongating their lives through medical interference, waking up every day, I'm, you know, here I am again and I expect to be kind of attitude. I think though still, like you use the term will versus body, right? Will, I take that, ego. Could be another word, could it not?
Could be, yeah.
Yeah. I think, I mean, in my tradition, shall we say, legacy, whatever, Eastern thing, there is a lifelong practice of moving out of that mind, story, will thing into the intuitive place, shall we call it? You want to call it soul, Buddha, mind? I mean, there's so many different words for this, but something behind this thing, way inside of your place where you hold trust. that if that is worked on, even given these other circumstances, which are pernicious, there's no doubt about it, you know.
Yeah.
If that perspective shifts enough, there may be a better opportunity to relate with the transition, basically.
Surely. Surely.
That's my surely thought.
And I think the flip of that, the other face of that, is that there's such a thing as too late.
Mm.
And it's the sooner North Americans hear that phrase and feel it in their bones, the better for all concerned. There is such a thing as too late. Yeah. Baby, stop waiting.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I speak to next generation through this podcast or other work that I do. And say, this is, you know, we're talking about something that you may be inclined to completely dismiss because of your age.
Right.
But this is a way to live more fully now,
right,
to engage yourself in this way. Can you talk, there's one, you know, a law in physics that you talk about, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. Can you talk about that? I found that fascinating, and I had never encountered it.
Heisenberg, by the way, is the generation of physicists prior to Oppenheimer,
as
a matter of note. Oh. Yeah. Oh. And they knew each other, I think.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle sounds wonky and carnivalesque when I'll describe it to you. But the consequences are really quite something. It goes like this. So it was born in the realm of quantum physics. So quantum physics is basically, for the longest time, theoretical, because there was no technology that could establish the material reality that was being posited in quantum physics, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was all, if this is so, then, and so on. Yeah. But it was not really observable in its primary state.
Mm.
Okay. And so then they've developed certain technologies that enabled them to arrest certain, I can't do justice to this on the physics level, but to arrest certain base elements and make them observable, okay? And traceable and trackable and all the rest. And Heisenberg, and probably others too, said, but wait a second. If we go that way, and it's clearly the way we're going because we don't have an alternative, then it behooves us to realize that what we're observing here is not the building blocks of reality. What we're observing here is the consequences of our intervention into the building blocks of reality. So we're forever looking in a kind of intervention mirror or interference mirror, right? And those are the consequences that we interact with, the upshot of what we do. That's what he was saying at the level of physics, but you can hear the not only the rational, but the ethical other side of that, which is mistaking and forever mistaking your take on things for the things. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, he, you speak to it really well also in the book. The idea is the true nature of a thing is very available to you, provided that you obviate yourself to the point where you are purely receptive when you are a non-event in the process of observing. You get out of the way, and now you're capable of objectivity. That is a gigantic spiritual truism.
It seems to me objectivity would be best understood as the view or the perspective from nowhere.
Yeah, or no preferences is another way, perhaps.
No particulars, maybe.
Yeah, all of the above.
Yeah.
There's one interesting chapter you talk about hope, which you personify as a tyrant. And I don't know if you've ever, somebody who's done a lot of work with death and dying is Roshi Joan Halifax. Is that ever, you know who she is?
I've never met her, but I'm alert that she's in the world. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've done stuff with her in the past and so on. She's a marvelous person and very wise. And we talked about hope one time, maybe on a podcast. And she came up and she said, well, hope in and of itself is, it's empty. Not empty in the Buddhist empty, which is full.
Not good empty.
Not good empty, yeah.
Right.
But I would say wise hope, where you're not expecting a certain outcome. You're not bargaining to get anything. You are combining with an attitude that explores is curious and explores the mystery and looks to what might be, you know, a right action. What do you think about that versus how you talk about it for quite a bit, the tyrant hope?
It's true. You know, hope and me haven't got along for a long time. And hope may win. I mean, in the marketplace of ideas, clearly hope wins every time when it's confronting me. But I would say the scenario you just described is imminently workable, practical, doable, without the substrate of hope, as if the notion being that hope would somehow make that more possible or more likely. I just simply don't. Here's where my take on hope comes from, I should say. I don't have any inherent feelings about hope. But what I did instead was I observed people in the throes of hope as they died. Okay, so that's the particulars of my investigation. I was observing what being hopeful did to dying people, what it obliged them to do, what it obliged them to set aside. And the conclusion that arrested me was that hope resembles a mortgage in a deeply unfortunate way. The notion being that a mortgage functions by making certain things impossible to achieve in the present moment because your money is being siphoned off for the sake of a future ownership, outright ownership, whatever it is.
Mm.
Hope functions virtually identically from everything I saw. In other words, nobody hopes for the way it is. We hope for the way it isn't there. And the flip side of that would be this to me. So here you and I are talking. And one thing is palpably unnecessary for us to talk. And that is us hoping that we're sitting here talking. We don't have to hope that.
Yeah.
We can do it minus the hope. Now, I'm not an idiot. I mean, I can certainly observe with the best of them the apparent payday that hope seems to bring to people who are going through it. I get that part. I really do. I get that part. My caveat, my warning signal is this. At what point do you get to stop being hopeful? When is the payday of being hopeful? Or is hope a little bit like a crack habit, that the more hope you have, the more hope you need. The more hope you need, the more hope you have. And there doesn't seem to be a statute of limitations on the whole arrangement. Particularly if the hope for thing never comes to pass, which in the death trade, it rarely came to pass. So dying people were dying with their hope not reconsidered, but annihilated instead. You see? And you know, an element of that would be, how many times was I asked in interviews in those days, and even now, did I find that people with a spiritual or religious orientation to their lives somehow miraculously had better outcomes than people who were, you know, the great unwashed, non-aligned crew?
Yeah.
And my answer routinely was, nope, I didn't see any particular upside or benefit that exhibited itself amongst the devoted when it came to dying. And here's why. Because their devotions were crafted not with the realities of dying in mind. Their devotions were crafted, and their understandings, I should say, were crafted to keep the realities of dying at bay. That's how it actually worked itself out. And then it's a terrible come down when you realize that your devotions, when it comes to dying, it's dying one, and your devotions, nothing.
What's the reality, Stephen, of dying?
What's the reality? Well, I think I used it in the plural. So I think I find it more opportune to say the realities of dying.
Realities.
What I mean by that is that it's bigger than you. Maybe I'll tell you briefly the story. I took my son and his young friend when they were about 7 or 8 years old to the local friggin' carnival or crazy place, you know? And I hated the rides because they made me nauseous, but they're desperate to go on one, and they had to go with an adult. So I volunteered reluctantly. And it was one of these things that they just hauled you up to a Jesus unholy height and then just dropped you. And you're on some kind of bungee thing. So, you know, you're rescued at the last minute and annihilation was averted. This is supposed to be fun. Well, I was beside myself with terror as we were being raised higher and higher, so that you could see from King City, north of Toronto, you could see Niagara Falls. I mean, I thought, this is just wrong. And this is no visible means of support. And it was God awful. I couldn't speak. Okay. When I finally could get a word out and I had these two young guys on either side of me, I just said this, sorry. I mean, I'm laughing about it now, but I was absolutely terrified. That's as close as I've ever been to the momentum of dying, where this thing is hauling you up and you have no recourse. And all your investment in personal development and you know, the range of certainties that you rely upon, these things don't obey the realities of dying. And the realities of dying simply don't consult your belief system. In other words, as I understand it, death is a deity. And so it needs to be learned, right? And it needs to be, in a sense, accommodated, if not welcomed, that you exercise a degree of kind of a radicalized hospitality that doesn't seem naturally occurring, because it's not there to win. It's there to, so that life prevails and you finally and epically and elegantly don't win. So you know that great line from I believe it was Rilke. Rilke's great, and if it's not Rilke, maybe it should have been, but it's the gist of it was, we're not here to succeed. We're not here to win. We're here to be defeated by greater and greater things.
I don't know that. That's phenomenal.
Yeah. So death is one of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're at the end of our time, but I found something in the book that I think it's a nice way to close this conversation that I want to read. Waking up each day is a gift. It's a gift that is not reward for playing by the rules. It is a gift from the gods, giving each living person the capacity not just to go on, but to go on as if he or she has been gifted to go on in gratitude and wonder that all the things of the world that keep them alive have continued while they slept. Wonder, awe, and a feeling of being on the receiving end for now of something mysteriously good.
That's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah, it's effing great, Stephen.
Thank you. I'm thank you for reading that out loud. I don't read my own stuff, and to hear it, especially with the generosity with which you know, pronounced it all, it was a delight to hear it, actually. And I quietly admire that guy at that time.
Lovely. Anyhow, everybody, this is a book that I highly recommend. It'll be in the show notes that you know, we'll link it up so you can get Stephen's book. And Stephen, does a lot of, I don't know if you do workshops anymore, but I know you speak around the world, basically.
True.
And we'll get a website and all of that to you, or social media, whatever, so you can connect. And again, this is, and I don't care how old you are. It is important, and it is really part. It's as important, for instance, as what's going on ecologically in this world, as much as what's going on polarization of society. This is important. So thank you for being here, Stephen.
Amen. Thank you for the invitation, and for the kind considerations that what I've been trying to work on, you let them in for, and it's really very kind. I appreciate it.
All right, everybody, this is Mind Rolling on Be Here Now Network. We shall see you next week. Bye-bye.